I'm Darius Larson, the village philosopher here for one more week. I'm the Lutheran campus pastor at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. I've been here now for 2 weeks. And today we're going to spend an hour taking a look at part of Ephesians, part of the fifth chapter of Ephesians. And I think that Dan Erlander later in this week will be doing his very brilliant work on going all the way through the book of Ephesians. I asked him if there was one part of Ephesians that he doesn't, elevate or stress too much, and he says he kind of skims over the fifth chapter. So based on that, I thought this would be an appropriate one then for me to do. You can ask him why he doesn't know. That'd be unfair. Ephesians, I take it, there's a lot of discussion on really what was the intent of Ephesians, and rather than going over all of that, I assume that the book of Ephesians is basically a work to instruct those about to be baptized. People have said it was a circular letter to different cities, and tacking on which city it was going to, in this case, Ephesus. The phrase that our title comes from, wake up from your sleep, or in the RSV it says, awake, O sleeper, comes from a hymn, an ancient first century hymn, most likely a refrain of some larger hymn, wake up from your sleep, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. And I would like to start off by sharing a little bit about what I think that may mean, and then a little more background on Ephesians, then move into more detail the fifth chapter, and at any time raise your hand if you want clarification or if you want to ask a question, please do so. The sleeper, wake up from your sleep, was the non-Christian, or depending on your interpretation, it could be not only the non-Christian in the pagan sense, but also the Gnostic. Gnosticism, much of Ephesians deals with a lot of kind of sexual things. And I think that was a reaction to Gnosticism in the early church. Gnosticism was that belief that the body was basically pretty worthless. It was worthless in the sense that one's mind had already been illumined or enlightened to such an extent that one no longer needed the body. And if one no longer needed the body, you had two ways of dealing with the body. One, and some Gnostics did this, went to kind of an extreme asceticism in which you denied any sort of pleasurable things in one's body, or if matter did not matter, one could do whatever they wanted with the matter, with one's body, because the body in the end was inconsequential anyway. Therefore, a lot of Gnostics started living rather loose lives because their mind could still remain pure and holy and wholesome and all those other sorts of things. Needless to say, many of the early church people were saying, were questioning that. I was wondering about the properness of that. And much of Ephesians deals and takes that into account. It may be a update on what Gnosticism is for today. It could mean lots of things. I'd want to use Robert J. Lifton. He's a psychological historian who talks about the number one neurosis in the world today is psychological numbing. That we no longer feel. We no longer can sense, we no longer are alive in feeling pain or joy. We can watch a TV program and it can be the evening news or Cops and Robbers and we have the same emotive response to it. A death that's fake, or a death that's real, we just sit back and go, there goes, so it goes, as Kurt Vonnegut says. And what Ephesians calls us to is wake up from that numbingness. wake up from that type of existence which you just kind of could care less about other people. Let us be concerned, let us be sensitive to those people. The ancient baptismal rite, maybe I should just briefly go into that, in the early church, began in Ash Wednesday, 40 days of Lent in which you got basic instruction leading up to the Easter Vigil. And what I'm disappointed in today's church is that we have eliminated the no in our baptismal rites. We say, do you renounce the devil and all his empty promises, empty works? Yes, by the help of God. Where and when in today's church do we shout no and name the demon? Now, the demon may be different for each of us. But in the early church, you would literally face west and you would shout no. And you would shout no in such a way that you would name that which you're saying no to. And somewhat humorously, you're almost saying the devil won't get me. You know, you stick your tongue out at the devil and name it. And we can each name that which we think we need to name. Many people would name on a more global sense the arms race, that we put our faith and security and trust in that. Many people would name more personal, moral types of things that we are trying to struggle with. But anyway, once you name it, once you say no to that, then you turn to the east, to the rising sun, not the setting sun, despair, hopelessness, but you turn east to the rising sun and you say yes. You say yes to the loving God and you go down into the baptismal waters and you do battle with the devil after putting on spiritual armor and all these other beautiful things, but this isn't on baptism, this is on Ephesians. You come up out of the water to a new life and you get a new robe. A lot of Ephesians says you take off and you put on. What is it that you're taking off? That's the nose. What is it that you're putting on? That's the yeses. So what we're going to look at today is some of the yeses. To summarize chapter 1 through 3, I could basically summarize it by saying we are saved and we are chosen. That's a given in Ephesians. It means that we believe that God means us well. God is a God who is trustworthy. And the problem is, and this comes into chapters 4, 5, and 6, therefore we ought to live like that. And all too often we don't live like God means us well. We live in a state of non-trust. We live in a state of suspicion. We don't live in a state of graciousness. Ephesians, if it's anything, it's a book about trying to help us understand that life is gracious. And once we realize that life is gracious, we need to live life graciously. The first verse of Ephesians 5 says, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children. Just a footnote on that, imitators of God, this is the only place in the New Testament where we're called to be imitators of God. Every other place we're supposed to be imitators of Christ or be like Christ, or be like Paul who is like Christ. But this is the only place in the New Testament where it says to be imitators of God. It may not make a whole lot of difference, but I think the emphasis is on be gracious like God is gracious. That if we believe that God means us well, then we should mean other people well. We should live a life of graciousness like God has lived a life of graciousness towards us. And when you add that second part of verse 1, as beloved children, people like myself who have currently two children, 27 months and 7 months, are learning a lot about imitation. Sarah, just in the last couple days, 7-month-old, is learning how to clap. Whenever I clap, she would go like this for the longest time. She's finally getting the horizontal movement down now and responding. She's been imitating my smile for a long time. I can smile and she smiles and it's so cute. Christopher, you can repeat any word you want, and he'll repeat it back to you. He will mimic it back to you. He is imitating us. And what it is, it's a free thing. He's not wondering what I will think. Maybe he is. That's why he's imitating it back, but that's another story. He's not concerned with if it will come out. I mean, when I say Christopher, he says, how does he say it, Cindy? How does Christopher say Christopher? I don't know, Istifer or something like that. It's not quite right, but he doesn't not say it. He says what he thinks he can, and it's a freeing up thing, because I would hope that he sees at least the world, his environment, graciously. He's not afraid. He can deal with life and reality in an open way. And he has taught us, and Sarah's teaching us, to live life that way as well. Because if nothing else, it says, be imitators of God, because I belong to this family, is another way of saying it. I can risk trying to think that I can have the audacity to imitate God, because I know that God means me well. Now, just one word of caution on this point. We all know the difference between egocentrism and being theocentric, or God-centered, or self-centered. A word of caution that let us not assume that we know what imitating God is all about, and therefore think that we're so great because we are theocentric. I think the task before us is to be what I like to call theo-eccentric. Got that? God crazy. No, it's, that when you're egocentric, you're centered on self. When you're God-centric or theocentric, you're centered on God. But the problem is, you just think you are. You're only imitating part of who and what God is all about. If you ever think that you know what God is all about, you don't know what God is all about. I call that greased watermelonisms. Just when you think you got that greased watermelon and you're starting to swim with it, it slips out from you and you're forced to swim after it. So that we are really called to be theocentric, but we live our lives as theo-eccentric. Another way of saying that, I don't trust people who practice what they preach. Because you water down your preaching then. Your practice should be pointing towards what you're preaching, but it better be challenging me as well as other people. If I ever practice what I preach, it's not worth listening to. But it doesn't mean I shouldn't attempt to practice what I preach, and that's what Ephesians 5 is all about. Let's get into that. Ephesians... In fact, we're going to skip a few verses here. I want to jump right ahead to Ephesians 5:15, because it gets into what Ephesians 1-14 I think are all about anyway. Ephesians 1 and 2 talks about that we need to learn how to walk in love. Once we realize that God is gracious, then we can live a lifestyle that is compatible with that graciousness. And one thing is you walk in love. Ephesians 3-14 is you walk in light. And Ephesians 15-20 is you walk in wisdom. And it's 15-20 which I want to spend most of our time with, and probably all of our time, and then open up with some questions. To walk in wisdom, one needs to do... at least I've discovered five things. Maybe we can discover more as we look at this together. If you can turn to Ephesians 5:15 and maybe the first part of 16, what is one thing we need to learn to walk, to do when we're walking in wisdom? What do we need to do if you take a look at that? Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time, because these days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but... oh, I jumped way ahead there. I already read two verses. Look carefully then how to walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time. To walk in wisdom, we need to what, according to that?
Look carefully.
Look carefully. Definitely look carefully. And how often do we look carefully? How often do we take things for granted? And while we look carefully, somebody else said it, we realize that these days are evil. I think there's a certain naivete, I think, in this world that the church is challenging now, and lots of other people are challenging. Things are getting better and better and better and better. And Jeremiah says, prophets are saying all is well, and all is not well. These days are evil. We have to name the nose. We have to know what that evil is. People are luring around and seducing us to all sorts of false wisdom, all sorts of ways of thinking that everything will be all right if only we can keep ahead of the Russians. Everything will be okay if we can only get this next weapon developed. Everything will be okay if we can just develop technology to this point where we can feed all the hungry. And therefore, we don't have to change our lifestyles. And what develops because of this is we develop a mutual suspicion of other people. We become selfish. We become in a state of non-trust because we need to be on top. If you go away with anything today, I want you to go away with an understanding of what the word style means. Too often we let things happen to us. That's that whole numbing nature. Style, in its proper sense, does not mean to fit in, but it means to be set apart. To be in style does not mean to wear alligator t-shirts or Holden Village sweatshirts or the right Nike, are those Nike shoes? The right Nike tennis shoes or the right NHS Orchestra Chicago Tour. Wow, 1983. You know, whatever it is, people think that to be in style means you have to fit in. But what the word means is to be set apart. Flannery O'Connor has said that you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you odd. By the way, don't do this too much. I've been saying this so often that people now are starting to actually do it. Next Ash Wednesday, go to the local Hallmark card shop and ask them for a Happy Lent or a Happy Ash Wednesday card. And they don't know what you're talking about. And that's good, because that's one season of the church year who is yet to be seduced by culture. But if enough of us say it, they may think it's a market, and then they may start publishing, you know, Happy Ash Wednesday to you. Remember, you are dust. Happy Ash Wednesday. I can just see it now. Maybe Holden can put them out, huh? But anyway, you can look at a David Nelson painting here, and you know it's not a Van Gogh. Why? Because Van Gogh has a certain style, and a David Nelson has a certain style. It's intentional. And my point is that what Ephesians is all about is to be intentional about your style. What is the signature that you want to write on life? We all too often just let that happen to us, don't we? We kind of, in hindsight, can talk about what kind of style, what sort of way we should live. Foresight, we don't have the foggiest idea what it's all about. And Ephesians says that if you're going to learn to walk in this graciousness of God, if you really believe that God means you well, and then you're going to live it, that means you have to be intentional about it. To want to do what one knows one ought to do is the quality of the new nature. Most of us know at least somewhat about what we ought to do. But the key is, do we want to do it? And what Ephesians is about is proclaiming the fact that those of us who have been baptized as children of the light now want to do it, not out of a fear of whether or not to be accepted or rejected, but in a living graciousness that now because God has bestowed God's graciousness on me, I can live a life of graciousness with others. And therefore, moving into the second part of verse 16, we need to make use of every opportunity. How many of us fail to make use of every opportunity because we fear that our act isn't together? I mean, I could have feared, and I did a little bit, but I could have feared that my act wasn't together about this Bible study today and not make use of this opportunity. And how many of us miss opportunities because we don't make use of them? Jean-Paul Sartre, in his play No Exit, deals with people, you know, let's say this is his play. And think the person sitting all around you are the people you would least like to be in this room. They are now your brothers and sisters in this room for eternity. That's the play. That's the setup. The normal interpretation of that play is hell is other people. And that could be true, but we won't dwell on that one. Here we are, can't stand each other, and there's no way out. The doors are shut, the windows are bolted, and we are stuck here with each other forever. Lo and behold, grace comes in late in the play, and the door mysteriously opens. But the problem is, it's dark out there. It's unknown out there. Nobody knows what it is out there. So they close the door, and they choose to remain in their own hell because they're fearful of the unknown. They are fearful of trusting the fact that God, this is not Sartre, this is my interpretation. They are fearful of the fact that they cannot trust the unknown. So they remain in their own hell. How many of us who are supposedly people of the light don't risk and don't trust and remain in our own hell? I think lots of us. Another couple quick examples. How many of you have seen either Close Encounters of the Third Kind or E.T.? Those are older movies now. Okay. Here you have the unknown, E.T. When you first see E.T., everybody is scared. This is something unknown. But you know, towards the end of the movie, we discover space is gracious. The unknown is beautiful. And don't you find, after seeing that E.T. person, that you start loving that guy, you start feeling close, that starts having a sense of beauty about this ugly thing? Unlike Star Wars with Darth Vader, you know, I hope that the world is more like E.T. and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, in which you can communicate with the unknown rather than blow the unknown to bits. But remember, there is evil in this world. But let's treat the stranger as a potential friend, not as an enemy. How many times do we reach out to unknowns? I mean, and I think when we think about the hearing impaired, to reach out, I don't know what to do. And so we don't, you know, because I'm not making use of every opportunity. And what this says to learn to walk is to learn to reach out and seize that moment and be like Eliot in E.T. And he was afraid at first, but at the end, you notice he was embracing E.T. And it was only the adults that brought the bombs out, that brought the guns out, and the police forces. They couldn't be imitators of God in the childlike fashion because they were suspicious. They were not gracious. Christopher and Sarah teach me a lot about graciousness. I'm trying to teach them a lot about sharing too, but that's another story. Verse 17, what does that say to us?
To walk in wisdom, we need to what? Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. To walk in wisdom, we need to what? That should be an easy one. What?
Understand.
Understand what? What the will of the Lord is. That's easy, isn't it? No, I think it goes back, I wrote that the last time. That goes back to that egocentric and theocentric and theoeccentric. Once you think you know what the will of the Lord is, be careful. Yeah. Once you think you may know, that's okay, I think. The foolish act selfishly, regardless of evil consequences. And this is a warning for us not to fall into that class. Consider instead the will of God. We have to discern what the will of God is. And once again, I come back to it and back to it. And it's a basic, whenever I'm teaching anything about Luther, and I got this from Bob Gaiser at the university, our Berkeley Seminary, whatever it's called. Pacific Lutheran? Yeah. No, well, I'll forget it. Anyway, he's the one who says God means me well is the key statement, or at least one of the key statements about Lutheran theology, or what Luther's theology is all about. And I come back and say that is the key statement about what Ephesians is all about, that God means me well. The will of God for me and for you, and to move further and further for all of the cosmos and the universe, is God means me well. Another footnote, Andy Burgess, who's the chair of our religious studies department at the University of New Mexico, he's Joe Burgess's brother. Some of you know who Joe Burgess, they're Lutherans way from way back. He wrote an article once in Christian Century called Earth Chauvinism. And this fits into the ET and the Ephesian stuff too. That what right do we have to think that Jesus Christ was the only incarnation of God? That we have this thought that God is only here on this earth, and he expands it to other planets all over the place. And let's be aware of earth chauvinism when it comes to the incarnation. But that's just a footnote. If God means me well, I shouldn't instantly, but I do, when someone cuts me off in traffic, think that they're out to get me. That if somebody looks at me somewhat strangely, think that they don't like me. When someone doesn't come up to me after this study and tells me that it was a good study, that they hated it. If God means me well, it means that maybe I should think little different thoughts. That maybe that person in the traffic was as in much of a hurry as I was, even though sometimes it's obvious that they're really trying to just cut me off. And when we get into this type of mentality, that life is suspect and everything is suspicious and we don't know who to trust, we have to then start building up our armament, and not only in a global sense, but how many of you have backyard patios? How many of you have front porches? Wow, we're doing pretty good. There's a movement afoot in America to the backyard patio and the high fences rather than the front porch. The front porch, at least architecturally, was a place where you would talk to your neighbors. You sit there and share with them and say hi to them. Now we're hiding from them rather than saying hi to them in the backyard in our patio. You know, how many of you have garages that are attached to your house versus not attached? You know, now you can just get in your car and drive out and you don't have to go outside anymore. Life is suspect. We don't know our neighbors anymore. And what the gospel tells us, what Ephesians calls us here, is to reach out to those people. To maybe to, at least if you don't have a front porch, like we don't have a front porch, maybe you should at least put your lawn chair out in the front yard sometime and say hi to your neighbors. The verse 18 deals with not getting drunk in wine, but rather being filled with the Holy Spirit. What's the opposite of being filled?
Empty.
What happens when one is empty? When life does not have meaning, we look for meaning anywhere we can. If we can't find it, then we at least are numb to meaning, right? We go back to sleep. How many of you know that depression, a sign of depression, is when all you want to do is nap? All you want to do is sleep. You don't want to live life. You just kind of, you know. And the ways of getting out of depression is to be physical, you know, to have an hour of physical activity, an hour of play. There's about five or six things that people say one should do to get out of depression, but it's becoming active again. It's feeling again and getting rid of the numbness. But life sometimes is too difficult for people, so they choose to be, or it's thrust upon them, numbness. And what this text tells me is that what the task is for people to believe that life is gracious is to concentrate on goodness and not on evilness. To acknowledge that there are evil times, but to also to acknowledge that there is good in this world. Harvey Cox has said that in the Feast of Fools, that the problem with world changers is that they're not world celebrators. And the problem with world celebrators is that they're not world changers. And what we need to do is to find people who can celebrate and change. And I think that's what Holden's all about. You know, we push hard here at issues. We challenge each other. But like last night and other nights, we know how to celebrate. We know how to throw parties. If Dan Erlander does his thing on the fear and faith in the nuclear age, go to it. Or if not, listen to the tape. Tape one, or session one, is all on fear and depression and this terrible world. And he says, I want to leave you the next day with thinking that you can be concerned about the nuclear arms race and still party. You know, that's what this is all about. The movie The Exorcist was out several years ago, and people were all concerned about being filled with evil spirits and needing to be exorcised from it. I heard one person remark that if we would be equally as concerned about being filled with goodness, the devil could never enter in, could never find any room in us. But sometimes we get, and I'm not talking about sure or positive thinking type of stuff. I'm talking about knowing truly, and I'll repeat it one more time, that life is gracious. Life is good. God means me well. Sin equals non-trust. Sin means that I do not believe that God means me well. When I do not believe that God means me well, then I start separating myself from God and from others. And that's when the numbness comes in. And I no longer hope like I used to. And then it's just a downward spiral. I'm sure Granger could tell us lots about people that aren't whole because of that, or do not realize, I should say, that they are whole. And then verses 19 and 20 here deal with what I think is one of the most important things. To walk in wisdom, we need to do liturgy. We need to worship. We need to do doxology. We need to praise God. And I think what this says is that God can produce good out of the most unpromising situations. Lots of people think that Ephesians was probably written about 80 to 90 AD. This is after the fall of Jerusalem. People were thinking that the end was coming very soon. The Roman Empire was really in its heyday, trying to control Jerusalem and the rest of Palestine. And people could have been really depressed. How do you keep hoping in the midst of a world that seems to be falling apart all around you? You understand that God can work wonders through it all. My dad died at age 57 of a heart attack about 4 years ago. I could have said that that was God's will. I don't buy that. I would rather say that it was evil. It was one of those no's I want to shout. But that I believe that meaning can come out of the most absurd event, my dad's death. That I can grow as a result of it. I do not believe that God caused it to happen so that I could have this beneficial learning experience. But I believe that it happened, and those who are strong in faith can transform goodness out of evil. And that's what I think Ephesians is talking about in a more cosmic sense. That the world is messed up. There are problems in this world. And somehow, we, by focusing in on and naming what those evils are, doing battle with those evils, and then turning to the rising sun and letting the light come in and scatter the darkness. And that's what baptism is all about. We can continue. My dissertation topic is on a baptismal spirituality. Lutherans have a problem with the word spirituality because it reeks sanctification. And we are saved by grace. But if nothing else, Ephesians, I think, puts this all in the proper light. That if we can daily affirm our baptism, if we can daily affirm that it is a God who justifies, it is a God who means us well, then maybe we will have the guts to risk, to reach out, to attempt to do some things that we normally would not do. And that's the sanctification process, if it's grounded in a justifying God. Let me pause here and see if in what way this rings true to you, in what way this may not ring true, or any comments or any illustrations any of the rest of you may have on it. Is there any questions at this point? Or statements? Yeah.
Well, it seems to me as though the hardest thing in the world for us to do is to really know God's graciousness and to experience this. And that, to me, is at the base of it. And, you know, we can say it and intellectually. We know, yes, we are saved by grace, you know, through faith. And, but to really experience it, I think once we've experienced it, then these things that come out of that come in a different way. Then it's not that we are doing it, but God through us is, you know, helping us. But to... I think this what you're saying is so basic, and how can we help each other, or what, you know, how to come to know God so well and know God's love and God's graciousness, and it's basic. Everything else comes after we know that, after we experience it.
So how do we experience it? Yeah, yeah, back here.
And to try to find, like, what does God's graciousness mean to you in pictures? Or, you know, all the abstract grace and just all the abstract words, try to find a symbol that you can relate to. I think that's how it becomes meaningful. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say what you said about, like the Father says, and so forth, the things can become the good. Peter says that, and that taught me very much too. The evil that is intended, once it passes the throne of God, the error is turned into good. And I think that happens through prayer. When something happens to us and we pray about it, then the arrow goes instead of destruction or evil into good, and I think that's very helpful in whatever situation.
I have met some beautiful people down in Mexico City who work with the poor. And whenever I watch them, they do this, you know, kind of like a Mother Teresa type, you know, in, with such loving care. And I'm there for 3-4 weeks, and I'm burnt out. I'm depressed. I think the whole world is messed up. And I ask them, how do you continue day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year? Don't you get burnt out? And their answer is, no, it feeds me. It gives me hope. I'm working on it. So it's not only meditation, but it's that being involved with people in this world that somehow we see the graciousness in the midst of just ugliness.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something else?
Well, being filled with the Spirit, you know, being open to the Spirit, I bet they are filled with the Spirit. I bet they, you know, and through meditation and through other people, I don't know if it's a receptivity or it's the willingness to be open to God coming in, to the Spirit. Once that openness is there, He will be there.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's a lot easier to be gracious than to receive the graciousness. And sometimes I get the feeling that myself and a lot of people that guilt stands in the way of the receptivity of graciousness. God is good to me. Why? I'm not worthy of it. How do you get off that treadmill?
Yeah.
Because in order to feel the forgiveness, you have to receive the graciousness. The guilt stands in the way. It's like a block.
Yeah.
It just dawned on me, and we're saying that the film Tender Mercies really deals with that. You know, all the questions of why evil to some and graciousness to others. And I recommend that film.
Somebody once said that, and I think it's a good question that I'm trying to answer in my life. Why do some people get it and other people don't? You know, you can say get whatever, but some people seem to understand and some people seem not to understand. And is it experience? Is it some people just intellectualize or not?
I feel that God treats Christians and non-Christians alike. I mean, I think that's life, and God helps us through this veil of tears. And to me, then, God is the comforter. If I lose someone in death, or there's a tragedy, He's there to comfort me and help me carry on. I really feel that we're all alike and all part of the same thing.
There's a danger. There's several dangers, but there's a danger in always directing graciousness. Maybe that's where we have to start. I'm not sure about this. To ourselves. Because once, I don't know if we understand the gracious life by understanding it in ourselves first, or understanding it as we relate graciously to other people. And although I'm a firm believer in prayer and meditation and what Ephesians is all about, what baptism is all about, is let us proclaim that we are justified and let's get on with our work.
But we first have to know, we first have to experience, or at least they go hand in hand.
Yeah, but the problem is, yeah.
Me doing it, not God in me.
But then in response to that, if I'm understanding this, make use of every opportunity, that all too often we say, well, maybe I don't fully understand this yet, so I got to study it more, or I got to do that. If anything, I think these 5 verses of Ephesians tells us to go for it, to risk it. At the same time,
you know, not a reckless abandonment, but at least a hang loose in the saddle type of thing. I would think. Any of you who know horseback riding, people who first get on a horse, you know, tend to grip a little tight. All you get is sores. You know, the mark of a good horse person is to hang loose in the saddle. You know. But you still got to hang there. You can't just ride them, cowboy, you know that type of thing. Let me just share. Let's just move on, because this is a fun one. Verses 21 and following. I want to just get into a little bit of that, and then we'll probably have to call it quits if I can find my notes on it. This is this one that everybody talks about in regards to being submissive. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. As the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be subject to everything to their husbands. Husband, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he may be might sanctify her, having cleansed her with the washing of the water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without any spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies, so forth. This mystery is a profound one. What do we do with that? If I could find my notes, I could tell you. it's right here. Here we talk about learning how to walk, and they go, okay, now let's give you an example of this. And you go, that's what the new life is all about? Rather than having us struggle with unpacking it, because we don't have time for that, let me tell you what I think it says, and then see if you agree with me. It first states what is not new. Marriage is a good thing. Wives should respect their husbands. Okay, Paul, or the author here, is saying that I believe in the established order. There are good things in this, the way we order things, okay? Given. Now, what is new? Men, you should also respect your wives. What? That's never been said before. I thought women were just property. I thought I could do with them as I pleased. But what is revolutionary here, for those who live graciously, they can even do graciousness to their spouse. You mean you want me to consider a woman equal to a man? My Lord and my God, what's going on here? That's what this is. That's the intent of this. And we usually just get into the submissive stuff. And the submit should probably be, I like it translated, respect. But that's another argument. What is new is that men should also respect your wives. And also, they are not just property, and therefore you should treat them as Christ treats the church, graciously. And this is the radical gospel, that we live that life that our hymn says to arise, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give you light. What is that light? That light is a light of compassion. That light is a light of concern. That light is a light that cares about the effects my actions have on you. Because that is what Christ feels about Christ's church. And that's what men should feel about their wives. And it's always been known that wives should do that about their husbands. So, do you think that's what this text is saying?
When I read this section, I always think it's helpful to remember that husbands are being told to be lords in the way that Jesus was a lord. Remember the verses that we heard last night about what kind of Lord he is. Certainly not in the way that kings and rulers are in this world, where they have to prove that they're important by putting other people down and making them submit. But Jesus is the Lord as a servant who humbles himself.
Lord means in that sense, and I think this would be consistent with Ephesians, to be vulnerable, to be open to being wounded. Because if we are supposed to be imitators of God, which starts this chapter off, that's definitely what God was like. Yeah?
I think one thing that irks me is when people criticize this passage, they dwell on verses 21 to 24, stop, and they use it kind of as a weapon or a club or a sermon, and they'll get on into what the role of a male is in the relationship.
And the problem is, traditionally or historically, the church has done that as well, in much of how we have dealt with things. And it's only because of, and I think we can, hermeneutically speaking, take into account our cultural situation to see newness here, and probably more originally what it's supposed to have meant too. But when you get theologians for generations upon generations being men, you get some distorted views about what life is all about because we're out of balance. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
I know one time here in this room we were talking about knowing the will of the Lord and praying about things, and the lecturer said, the problem with that is you can get paralyzed. You can say, well, I don't know what the Lord wants for me. I'm just going to have to wait. I can't make a decision. And he said, I feel that I fall in love. I choose the woman I want for my wife. Then I ask God to bless the union. And that was something that you were saying, you know, get out and go to work.
In one sense, what Ephesians is all about is dealing with, I suppose you could call it, threshold situations.
Right.
You're in the threshold, you're moving into a direction. What direction? It's that book that all the staff people seem to be reading, The Road Less Traveled. See, you know, where do I go? Which stepping stone? I have this option and this option and that option and that option. And too often people choose no option.
Right. They decide because, not to decide.
Yeah. So they come to hold them. I said that during the staff time too last hour. But it is amazing. But it's a good place if one's intentional about that styling, back to that original point. That if you're saying, I'm at Holden here to figure out what my signature life is, and once I know that, then I can see where that will fit in to how to walk in the, as people call it up here, the real world. As if this is not the real world. Yes?
Joseph Smart, I was reading from the book Preaching for the People by Lowell Erdahl, and he summarized one of his chapters asking, what should we preach? We should preach God's yes, God's no, and God's go.
Yes, yes.
And that was the summary.
Yes, no, and yeah, go. Right. Yes, no, and go. Probably in conclusion, I would like to just say what? Not only is what I said about the book of Ephesians, but it's about baptism. That if we truly believe that we are baptized children of God, we can trust the fact that God is trustworthy. We can hope in the midst of hopelessness. We can reach out in that dark, dismal abyss because we know that there's going to be some loving hands leading us, holding us, or at least catching us when we fall. And it frees us up to be radically involved in the world. Christians, I believe,
should be, if they understand the graciousness, not only intellectually, but back in your gut, be the most socially active, politically astute people that this world has ever seen. Let me close with a story of another person I met in Mexico, whose husband worked for the State Department in New Orleans, although she was from Mexico. She's not living in Mexico now. She tells the story of how they threw all these parties for other foreign dignitaries and stuff, and they had these black servants to wait and wait on them and everything else. And New Orleans back in the 60s was a real racist town, she said. And the problem with it is that she really had trouble trying to live a life of the gospel in all of this. And she had what she described, she didn't just say it this way, but I heard it, she had a nervous breakdown. And she struggled with scriptures to try to understand what it was all about. And she said, one day I lost the respect of many of my so-called friends, but I became a human being. And I think what the gospel challenges us to do is to become human. And sometimes it does things that other people will look at not too favorably. And maybe we can do a forum on that sometime to discuss what that is. So let us go in the graciousness of God and serve God in that graciousness. Thank you.